Does the COVID-19 pandemic mean you should skip even small family gatherings? What experts say? And with video calls and an army of volunteers, this 15-year-old is battling the pandemic loneliness in nursing homes. First, we'll look at the numbers. From the Odessa American, Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 7,074. Ector County negative, 27,130. Out of 34,584 tested, with 380 pending, 121 deaths. Recovered, 5,650. Active, 1,303. ECISD daily cases, 14 students, 8 staff. Midland County, 5,843 confirmed, 98 deaths. And from the MISD dashboard, total confirmed cases still at 330. From the Midland Memorial Hospital's dashboard, they are still reporting 47 out of 50 beds for COVID patients are occupied. From the Texas Tribune, average new cases increased by 760 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 4th, 9,048 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 222 patients compared with a week ago. As of November 4th, 5,872 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths increased by 18 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 4th, 126 new deaths in Texas were reported. And West Texas Intermediate is trading at $38.91, down 24 cents. Here are coronavirus briefs. Months ago, the notion of the United States recording more than 100,000 coronavirus infections in a single day seemed inconceivable. But surging caseloads in nearly every state pushed the tally to a record 104,004 new infections Wednesday. And that wasn't even the day's biggest news story. As Americans anxiously waited to find out who their next president will be, 18 states reported record numbers of patients hospitalized with COVID-19. More than 1,110 fatalities were tallied, pushing the total number of coronavirus deaths reported since February past 233,000, according to data tracked by the Washington Post. Five highest single-day coronavirus case totals in the U.S. occurred in the past week. The global case count has surpassed 48 million, according to the World Health Organization. At least 10 coronavirus cases have been linked to an early voting site in Southampton, New York. Suffolk County Executive Steve Ballone said in a Wednesday news briefing that 6 of the people who tested positive for the virus were poll workers. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said Wednesday that a new economic stimulus bill should be finalized before the end of the year and will be the focus when the Senate resumes work next week. The CDC says it's time to develop a testing strategy to identify asymptomatic cases, as an estimated 40% of people with COVID-19 show no symptoms. Here are some short articles. Pandemic restrictions could make for a lighter flu season, by CNN's Terry Ward. The change of season usually ushers in predictable cold symptoms many people have grown accustomed to dealing with several times a year. But seasonal sniffles, colds, and flu have a harder time spreading when people are social distancing, wearing masks, and following other pandemic protocols. It's absolutely because of the precautions that we are taking, said CNN medical analyst and emergency physician Dr. Leanna S. Wynn. The same precautions that protect us against coronavirus also protect against cold, flu, and respiratory pathogens. It's the fact that you're keeping your distance, wearing a mask, washing your hands more, that you're attentive that someone might have the illness and not know it, said Wynn, who is a professor of public health at George Washington University. In the past, it might have been acceptable to be sneezing and cough a little and still go to work or school, and now that would not be acceptable, she added. That reduces the risk of transmission, too. Wynn pointed to Australia's milder flu season during its winter months as further indication that the same precautions used to protect protect against the coronavirus also reduced instances of the flu. Dr. Anthony Fauci has noted that Australia had the fewest number of flu cases in memory during its winter flu season from April to September. Fauci credited the flu shot, wearing masks, avoiding crowds, keeping physically distanced, and frequent hand washing as the actions that may have protected people in the southern hemisphere this winter. If you look at the data over many years about flu vaccines, they're not perfect, said Fauci, speaking with Washington, D.C. radio station WTOP on September 17th. We know from the data that flu shots not only prevent infections, they prevent people who do get infected from getting serious progressive disease, sometimes resulting in hospitalization. If you haven't already gotten your flu shot, the time is now, according to the experts. The start of the flu season in the Northern Hemisphere is usually November, Wynn said, and it's best to get vaccinated before November. Look closely at your medical bill, and you just might find a COVID fee. By the New York Times' Sarah Cliff and Jessica Silver Greenberg. A $900 nursing home bill, a $60 ambulance surcharge, a $45 dental tab. They are often called COVID fees, and they're popping up more often on medical bills. The coronavirus pandemic has made the practice of healthcare more costly, as providers must wear protective gear and sanitize equipment more often, even as they face declining revenue. To address this financial shortfall, some health providers are turning directly to patients. Surprise, COVID and PPE fees have turned up across the country in bills examined by the New York Times. It's a complicated answer. Who pays for this? Said Scott Maneker, a physician who is in charge of the American Medical Association's Practice Expense Committee. You look around the community and see additional costs being imposed right and left because of COVID-19. Barbershops, pedicures, and restaurants all have additional charges. It would be an undue burden to ask the medical community to bear this alone. But some of these fees, when millions of Americans are reeling after losing jobs and the health insurance that came with it, have drawn the attention of state attorneys general who say that charging patients directly can take advantage of vulnerable consumers or violate health insurance contracts and consumer protection laws. The new charges range from a couple of dollars to nearly $1,000. Two groups of providers have been especially hard hit. Dentists have lost billions since patients began postponing non-urgent dental care this spring. And assisted living facilities, grappling with lower overall demand, have also been forced to admit fewer residents to help stop the spread of infection. The cynical view is that some see this as an opportunity, said Darren Fowler, an assistant attorney general in Michigan, who has been investigating coronavirus fees in assisted living facilities. Everyone understands something unusual is going on, and most consumers are ready to embrace the idea that they will need to bear some expense. Unfortunately, in every setting, there are a percentage of folks who will take advantage of that situation. We'll read a few longer articles in a few minutes, but first we're going to bring you a pre-recorded feature from NPR. How will the U.S. distribute COVID-19 antibody drugs if they get FDA approval?
The Food and Drug Administration is evaluating two potential drugs that could help keep people healthy after they've been infected with the coronavirus. The FDA has not yet authorized them for emergency use, and so far there's no clear system for how to allocate them fairly or how to pay for these expensive products. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris reports.
There's a lot more to getting a drug on the market than cranking up a factory and getting FDA's stamp of approval. In the case of these drugs, which are called monoclonal antibodies, one of the most urgent questions is to figure out how to allocate scarce supplies.
Demand is going to far outstrip supply here.
Rena Conti at Boston University's Questrom School of Business says even though manufacturers are gearing up to produce more than a million doses before the end of the year, millions more newly infected Americans might be clamoring for these medications. President Trump got a dose of one of these drugs and has since told Americans that they too could get it at little or no cost. But Conti doubts that.
that is unprecedented in its statement. It's not realistic.
The drug itself could be free at first, but Conti says it's expensive to administer. It's given by IV infusion. Even people on Medicare have copays for many infused medicines. If that pattern holds, the copay for these COVID drugs could be many hundreds of dollars, considering Conti's estimate of a price tag around $2,000 to $10,000 per treatment. Then there's the question about how to allocate limited supplies. Dr. Jewel Mullen at the University of Texas Dell Medical School suggests using principles she helped develop for the National Academy's study of COVID vaccines. That would mean giving highest priority to healthcare workers.
And first responders, because we need them to be well. They're protecting us all the time. They're putting themselves at risk all the time.
Mullen says the drug should then go to vulnerable people who stand to benefit most, keeping the people at highest risk out of the hospital.
Maximize the benefit. Make sure everyone's valued and thought about equally and address health inequities.
That means making sure populations hard hit by the pandemic, often poor and people of color, get fair access, regardless of the cost of these medications. But equitable distribution has been a huge challenge with another scarce COVID drug, remdesivir, says Aaron Fox, a pharmacist at the University of Utah.
You know, I think about all of the problems that we had with remdesivir, and that was for a pretty narrow patient population.
At first, it was reserved for seriously ill people in intensive care units. The antibodies, by contrast, would be given to many more people, those who just got infected and aren't in the hospital. If demand sharply outstrips supply, Fox figures hospitals would be hard-pressed to follow a rubric based on equity.
If the amount that we get is so small, it's probably very likely that we would just use it for a short period of time and just use it up and not try to make some really difficult rationing decisions.
Another huge challenge is figuring out how to get these drugs to wherever they are needed most, says Nada Sanders, who studies supply chains at Northeastern University. The federal government plans to send supplies to each state.
The answer of simply saying, we're going to leave it up to the state, is not an answer.
Distribution itself is complicated and costly. These drugs must be shipped in temperature-controlled trucks and sent to destinations that are equipped to handle them gingerly. And they need to go to rural areas coping with outbreaks.
At the end of the day, someone has to pay for this.
If the federal government has a plan for that, it hasn't been revealed. And the clock is ticking. The FDA has been considering emergency use applications from Regeneron and Eli Lilly for 2 weeks now. And there's no saying how soon those deliberations will end. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And I have a few longer form articles that I've been saving to read. We'll get to some of those now. This is from the Washington Post. Why the coronavirus is killing more men than women? Men have weaker immune systems that in some cases may actually sabotage the body's response to an invader. But social and cultural factors may also play a role. By Ben Guarino, published October 17th. Early in the coronavirus outbreak, hospital data from China revealed a startling disparity. COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus, was killing far more men than women. That difference persisted in other Asian countries, such as South Korea, as well as in European countries, such as Italy. Then it appeared in the United States. By mid-October, the coronavirus had killed almost 17,000 more American men than women, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. For every 10 women claimed by the disease in the United States, 12 men have died, found an analysis by Global Health 5050, a UK-based initiative to advance gender equality in healthcare. That disparity was one of the many alarming aspects of the new virus. It bewildered those unfamiliar with the role of gender in disease. But the specialized group of researchers who study that relationship was not surprised. It prepared an array of hypotheses. One possible culprit was male behavior. Perhaps men were more likely to be exposed to the virus due to social factors. A disproportionately male workforce, for instance, could place more men in contact with infected people. Or men's lungs might be more vulnerable because they were more likely to smoke in the earliest countries to report the differences. What has become more evident 10 months into this outbreak is that men show comparatively weaker immune responses to coronavirus infections, which may account for those added deaths. If you look at data across the world, there are as many men as women that are infected. It's just the severity of the disease that is stronger in most populations in men. Frank Malvais-Jarvis, a Tulane University physician who studies gender differences in such diseases as diabetes. In such cases, a biology can explain why. The male immune response. Women generally have stronger immune systems, thanks to sex hormones, as well as chromosomes packed with immune-related genes. About 60 genes on the X chromosome are involved in immune function. Johns Hopkins University microbiologist Sabra Klein told the Washington Post in April. People with two X chromosomes can benefit from the double helping of some of those genes. Akiko Awakoski, who studies immune defenses against viruses at Yale University, wanted to see how sex differences might play out in coronavirus infections. She and her colleagues cast a proverbial net into the immune system to fish out schools of microscopic fighters. We did a holistic look at everything we measure immunologically, Alkoski said, listing a litany of the molecules and cells that form the body's bulwark against pathogens. Cytokines, chemokines, T-cells, B-cells, neutrophils, everything that we had access to. In male patients, the T-cell response was weaker, the scientists found. Not only do T-cells detect infected cells and kill them, they also help direct the antibody response. It's like a master regulator of immune response, and when you have a drop in T-cells or in their ability to become activated, you basically lose the conductor of an orchestra, Awakoski said. The power of the immune system wanes as people age, regardless of sex. But what is a gentle decline for women is an abrupt dive off a cliff for men. Awasaki's work indicates that T-cell response of men in their 30s and 40s is equivalent to that of a woman in her 90s. And T-cells aren't the only immune feature disproportionately impaired in men. Another paper, published in September by PLOS Biology, examined anonymous human genetic material collected along with viruses and nasal swabs. The study found throttled defense signals in men. When a cell detects a virus, it performs the molecular equivalent of yanking the fire alarm, said one of the study's author, Nicole Lieberman, a research scientist at the University of Washington. That alarm is manifest in genetic messengers called RNA, which react almost immediately. The reaction should cause cells to churn out the first lines of defense, such as interferons, immune system molecules that, as the name suggests, interfere with the virus's ability to reproduce. Other molecules summon specialized immune cells to destroy the pathogens. You want the fire alarm to go off for long enough that you can get the fire department there, Lieberman said. Lieberman and her co-authors, however, found that in men and some older populations, the fire alarm shuts off early, maybe even before the firefighters have arrived. That, I think, is the functional consequence, potentially, of what we're seeing here, she said. Harmful autoantibodies. Not only is the immune system in men weaker, but in some cases of the coronavirus, it may hobble itself. A study of nearly 1,000 patients with life-threatening COVID-19, published in Science in September, found evidence of molecular self-sabotage. Immune system fighters were acting against the body's defenses, like rebellious castle guards splintering their own gates. This flaw was much more prevalent in men than women. Specifically, the researchers detected what are called autoantibodies, molecules that bind and neutralize parts of the immune system. Those neutralizers disabled a subset of defender molecules known as type 1A interferon. Simply put, having antibodies led to more viral replication. 95 of 101 people with autoantibodies against interferon were male. Somehow males are probably more prone to develop such autoantibodies, but we do not know why, said study author Peter Broden, a pediatrician at Sweden's Karolinska Institute, who studies the immune system. Interferon molecules come in several types, so it's possible these patients could be treated with another flavor of interferon, Broden said. But that may be difficult, he acknowledged, because interferons are most helpful early in the course of an infection, before the disease progresses to life-threatening stages. The lack of killer T cells, coupled with neutralizing antibodies, is like a double whammy, Iwasaki said. That would then ultimately increase the viral load in these men. What's unusual about this result is that most autoantibody immune disorders appear in women, as is the case with the chronic disease lupus. Iwasaki's research is examining whether female immune systems may play a role in people with long-lasting COVID-19, nicknamed long haulers. There are thousands of people suffering from chronic symptoms, which may be debilitating, Iwasaki said. Many long haulers are young, and the majority of them, though not all, are women. Men behaving differently. Beyond these biological differences, it would be simplistic to ignore how gender's other aspects, such as behavior and social norms, may also influence the pandemic. Broadly speaking, men may be less likely to be worried about COVID-19 than women, fitting the pattern that women generally treat health risks more seriously. Women took a more cautious approach to the disease, a research poll found, expressing more concern they could return to workplaces safely. Women are also more likely to follow expert advice, such as mask wearing and social distancing, according to another study that included surveys and observations of pediatricians' behavior in New York, Connecticut, and New Jersey. Sarah Hawkes, a professor of global public health at University College London, who, with her husband, co-directs Global Health 5050, said that the image of men as risk-takers extends back hundreds of years to John Grant, one of the first people to participate in the field now known as epidemiology. After he reviewed England's death records, Grant postulated in 1662 that men, being more intemperate than women, die as much by reason of their vices. That is, male behavior was to blame. Hawkes argues that 350 years later, Grant's point still stands. It is undoubtedly a mixture of both biology and behavior, responsible for the health differences in men and women, she said. The share of coronavirus deaths in women also rises with their share of the full-time workforce, according to a report by University of Oxford economist Renee Adams that used Global Health 5050 data. The more you have women participating in the workforce, the smaller your sex difference becomes, Hawkes said. That lines up with gender inequalities. Men are more likely to work in environments where they are exposed to air pollution and other harms, Hawkes said. When women start to enter those traditionally masculine spaces, she said, it turns out women can get as sick as men. The gender disparities discovered in the response to COVID-19 have sparked a surge of interest in such differences more broadly. Almost nobody, apart from the people working in the field, were interested in that difference between men and women in disease until February or March, when the first results showed that more men were dying, Malvis Jarvis said. Even agencies at the forefront of public health, such as the CDC, were initially slow to reveal sex-disaggregated coronavirus data, Hawkes said. The UK public health surveillance system was similarly late. Hawkes took those delays as a sign of just how unimportant people considered this data, since it is so readily available. When people die, their death certificates state whether they were male, female, or in some places, non-binary. The CDC data finally made that information accessible in mid-April. The male skewed patterns revealed in those deaths conformed to what was seen in earlier outbreaks of Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, MERS. and severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS, both within the family of coronaviruses. And it is in line with other viral responses. We know that women develop much better antibody response to flu vaccines, Iwasaki said. Some of those experts are hoping to capitalize on this moment to shine a spotlight on other gender differences in health. The coronavirus, after all, isn't the only problem to afflict men and women unequally. So, too, do cancer, asthma, heart disease, and other common illnesses, Myovius Jarvis noted in a recent paper in The Lancet. The kinds of differences that we're seeing and outcomes in COVID-19 are not unexpected. They're not exceptional, Hawk said. If they're surprised, it only demonstrates the widespread underestimation of the differences in men and women that persist even among physicians, she said. Myovius Jarvis referred to this faulty approach as bikini medicine, in which clinicians view female patients as interchangeable with male ones, except for the organs covered by swimwear. The coronavirus has helped accelerate the trend away from that outdated view. The one positive that's come out of the pandemic, Hawk said, is the sudden realization that gendered social factors and biology may have a relationship with your life expectancy, your experience with illness, your risk of illness. It has made that conversation a little more real. Now here's another article from the Washington Post. When coffee smells like gasoline, COVID isn't just stealing senses, it may be warping them, by Allison Chu, published November 5th. Jennifer Spicer thought her days of feeling the effects of COVID-19 were over. The fever, chills, and severe fatigue that racked her body back in July had long dissipated, and much to the excitement of the self-described foodie, her senses of smell and taste were slowly returning. I thought I had recovered, said Spicer, 35, an infectious disease physician at Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta, who was exposed to the novel coronavirus through a patient. Although her senses hadn't fully come back, she was eating and drinking completely normally again. I felt a lot of relief, she said. But that relief lasted only until a Friday night in late October, when she took a sip from a freshly poured glass of red wine. It tasted like gasoline, Spicer said. She checked the bottle, found nothing wrong, then sampled the wine again. I was like, oh, this is not tolerable. This is not pleasurable at all, she said. I ended up dumping the entire glass of wine down the sink. It was that bad. The wine, though, probably wasn't the problem. Her experience is keenly similar to those of some other COVID-19 survivors who are recovering their sense of smell. Known as parosmia, the often temporary odor distortion makes things smell different and usually unpleasant, said Richard Doty, director of the University of Pennsylvania's Smell and Taste Center. It's more debilitating in some ways than loss of smell, Doty said. He noted that certain distortions, including one that causes everything to have a fecal-like odor, can make common food and drinks revolting because flavor is tied to sense of smell. Even water can become unpleasant, he said. For Spicer, the previously mouth-watering scents of cooked garlic and onions are now intolerable. Meat smells like it's rotting, and mint toothpaste is so off-putting that she had to switch to a bubblegum-flavored one. And perhaps worst of all, coffee's rich ammonia has been replaced with the pungent odor of gasoline. Coffee is really the saddest thing for me because I really just enjoy having a cup of coffee in the morning, Spicer said. Similar accounts of parosmia and a related odor distortion called phantosmia, which causes people to smell scents that aren't there, have flooded social media platforms in recent months. Facebook groups for those with COVID-related smell loss and distortions now have thousands of members. Some say they catch whiffs of cigarette smoke everywhere they go. Others can't identify the fetid smell that consistently assaults their senses. Yana Casey, 25, of Atlanta, said the stench is particularly bad when she is around cleaning supplies. It feels weird because my brain is trying to make the connection of, that's supposed to smell like bleach. But it doesn't smell like bleach, said Casey, who has yet to regain much of her sense of smell since she got sick in early July. It's something else, so it's just so much discomfort. The initial results of an international questionnaire published in June in Chemical Senses found that about 7% of the roughly 4,000 COVID-diagnosed respondents reported experiencing a smell distortion. Although experts don't know what overall proportion of patients will be affected by parosmia, it is probably a significant number, said Justin Turner, medical director of Vanderbilt University Medical Center's Smell and Taste Center. The distortions are often observed in people who are recovering from COVID-19 and starting to get their sense of smell back, Turner said. In many ways, having a parosmia in the setting of COVID-19 or any other viral upper respiratory infection that causes smell loss is actually kind of a good thing because it suggests that you're making new connections and that you're getting a regeneration of that olfactory tissue and returning to normal, he said. Much remains unknown about the human sense of smell, but some experts have a theory about how smell loss is linked to certain viruses, such as the novel coronavirus, that can lead to parosmia, said Danielle Reed, associate director of the Monell Chemical Senses Center, a nonprofit research institute in Philadelphia. One speculation would be that as the olfactory receptor neurons recover, regrow, and rewire into the brain, that they don't do it perfectly, Reed said. Instead of being wired so that a lemon smells like a lemon, the neurons wander a bit and don't connect properly, and so the brain is confused about how to interpret that information. Donald Leopold, a professor of otorhinolaryngology at the University of Vermont Larner College of Medicine, likened parosmia to playing a piano with missing keys. Normally you have a smell, let's say a rose, and a rose hits six keys, or neurons, Leopold said. If you have a cold caused by a virus, or if you catch the coronavirus and it kills some of the neurons, let's say you've got only three of those neurons left. That no longer allows you to smell a rose correctly. Just like if you hit those three keys, it wouldn't sound the same as the beautiful chord you played on the piano. Still, experts stressed that people experiencing parosmia should not panic. Though the process of regenerating olfactory cells is highly variable, Turner said, the phenomenon usually goes away as people regain their smell function. Research into parosmia and the aftermath of COVID-related smell loss is in extremely early stages, Reed said. But she and other experts noted that there are ways to reduce the negative impacts of smell distortions and help the recovery process along. Smell training, which has been recommended for people with smell loss, may be beneficial to those suffering from parosmia, as it could theoretically help their brains make the correct connections again, Turner said. It usually involves smelling different odorants, such as essential oils, at least twice a day for 10 to 15 seconds at a time over the course of weeks. Common scents used for training include rose, lemon, clove, and eucalyptus. It's very easy to do, and there's not really a whole lot of downside to it, other than we know it doesn't work for everybody, Turner said, adding that it can be done at home. Other potential fixes are more temporary, for instance, finding ways to plug the nasal cavity. Some people who are triggered by food and drinks and find it hard to stomach meals have solved the problem by putting a wet cotton ball in their noses, Leopold said. A similar effect can be created by taping the nostrils shut, Doty said. Although the flavor's not there, you don't have the disgusting flavor experience, he said. If those methods don't work and eating and drinking many things is nausea-inducing, Whitney Leisenmeyer, a spokesperson for the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, said it is still possible for people to maintain healthy diets. She recommended switching to smoothies, which can be a good way to still get a lot of nutrition packed in, but to make it a little more tolerable for people that are really not enjoying eating like they usually would. Leisenmeyer, an assistant professor of nutrition at St. Louis University, also encouraged people to research alternative foods that may be more palatable. For people who are unable to eat meat anymore, she suggested turning to dairy and eggs or other protein-rich foods such as beans, lentils, nuts, seeds, whole grains, and tofu. Spicer, the infectious disease physician suffering from parosmia, said she has tried to diversify her diet instead of just eating bland stuff and started taking a multivitamin. Recently, she learned she was able to tolerate a Thai curry dish. I was able to get something that had a lot of vegetables in it, and I don't know if the vegetables were okay on their own, but covered in curry sauce, they were okay, she said. In the absence of concrete answers, Reed urged people with parosmia to seek out others who may be having similar experiences, such as joining online support groups. Some people, I think, benefit enormously from just being able to talk to somebody else who's going through what they're going through, she said. That's not the same as a medical treatment, but I think some people get enormous peace of mind to just be able to unburden themselves with another person who can understand. Now here's a story from USA Today. The holidays are coming. Does the COVID-19 pandemic mean you should skip even a small family gathering? What experts say, by Jorge L. Ortiz, published October 21st. Dr. Eric Chio Pena and his wife come from large families and typically split the holiday festivities, getting together with one group of relatives for Thanksgiving and another one at Christmas. This year, they'll reluctantly keep their distance from both. We're going to have to make sacrifices, said Cho Pena, an emergency room physician and director of global health at Northwell Health in New Hyde Park, New York. My wife and I decided this year's going to be nuclear family, and we're not inviting anybody over. As the holidays approach and the number of coronavirus cases surge, millions of Americans will face the decision of whether to eschew traditional gatherings with family and friends or risk spreading the virus among loved ones. Anthony Fauci, the nation's foremost authority on infectious diseases, and Robert Redfield, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, warned about the potential for a spike in infections stemming from holiday parties, even if they're small and only among relatives. Memorial Day get-togethers were partly blamed for an increase in COVID-19 cases in the USA experienced early in the summer. Events such as a Sweet 16 party late last month in Long Island, New York, linked to 37 positive tests, and a wedding in August in Maine, which led to more than 175 infections, underscore the danger of relatively small social functions turning into super spreaders. Last week, health officials in the Washington area said small gatherings have been a factor in the region hitting a two-month high in coronavirus cases. All along, there have been issues about attending weddings, funerals, religious gatherings, and other events that are part of our normal life, said Dr. Stephen Wolf, Director Emeritus of the Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University. They bring people together and potentially become vectors for the virus. As many public health experts mention, the virus is attending these events and can be transmitted from person to person. Don't let the virus get to grandma. The CDC, which discourages traditional trick-or-treating this Halloween, updated its guidance Monday about holiday celebrations as people across the U.S. get ready to observe Thanksgiving and after that Hanukkah, Christmas, and Kwanzaa. The tips for in-person gatherings include commonly known mitigation measures, such as holding events outdoors, limiting their size, having participants wear masks, and maintaining social distance. The CDC encourages hosts to request that guests avoid contact with people from outside their household for 2 weeks before the activity, which becomes even more important now that the agency has redefined what is close contact with someone who has COVID. The impracticality of some of the safety measures, it's hard to fit everybody at a table 6 feet apart or to eat a meal outdoors in the late November chill, combined with pandemic fatigue and some Americans' defiant nature, will probably lead many to ignore the suggestions. I know there will be plenty of families who mock this kind of advice and say, that's ridiculous. We're going to get together and enjoy Thanksgiving like it's supposed to be, and no one's going to tell us otherwise, Wolf said. That may give them a sense of independence, but then the virus gets to grandma and she ends up in a hospital on a ventilator, and then you live with the guilt. Wolf and other experts recommend that families in separate households sit at their Thanksgiving tables at the same time and connect through a video platform such as Zoom, which might give a sense of sharing the meal. If members of different households congregate inside, opening windows would at least improve ventilation and could help diffuse the virus, reducing the chances of contagion. For Chao Pena, who works in public health and sees the impact of COVID-19 on a regular basis, the decision to find alternate ways to celebrate the holidays, though painful, was pretty clear-cut. I want to see my parents this Thanksgiving. I'd love to spend time with extended family. This year, it's not in the cards, said Chao Pena, who, along with his wife, plans a Halloween candy scavenger hunt in the backyard for their two young children, rather than have them go trick-or-treating with friends. Others with less direct exposure to the virus's ravages might be more tempted to take a chance, especially those who have avoided traveling to see relatives as the pandemic stretched over months. Weighing risks versus the pain of isolation. Craig Smith, an associate professor of psychology and human development at Vanderbilt University, said isolation over long stretches of sheltering in place can lead to a profound sense of loneliness and disconnection, particularly for those who have young children and are trying to balance parenting with work. Missing out on family gatherings would aggravate those feelings. Thanksgiving and the Christmas holidays are especially tough because, on top of the normal need to interact with friends and family, they are lifelong rituals for people of sharing those particular days and those particular meals, Smith said. So for many people, there's going to be a palpable sense of loss when they're unable to get their whole family together. But the risks, of course, are enormous. A study conducted for the Department of Defense indicates the risk of catching the virus on planes is minimal because of the aircraft's high turnover of airflow and use of HEPA filters. This week, the CDC strongly recommended that all passengers traveling on public transportation, including airplanes, and the onboard personnel wear face masks to avoid spreading the virus. The agency endorsed the removal, whenever possible, of anyone who refuses to comply. Those developments may prompt travelers eager for a family embrace to book a Thanksgiving or Christmas trip. Medical professionals still urge caution, noting that exposure to the virus could occur at several stages of a trip, and they insist it's best to avoid mingling with members of households from different areas, especially those from places with high infection rates. People should carefully weigh the risk of travel and risk of disease at the destination before deciding to go, said Dr. Jeff Goad, who teaches epidemiology, public health, and travel medicine at Chapman University. Certainly, older individuals and those with pre-existing medical conditions should only travel if absolutely necessary. Some turn to antigen tests. One of the emerging options for travelers and others who want to visit loved ones is getting tested for the coronavirus in advance, now that testing is more widely available. Dr. Peter Chin Hong, an infectious disease specialist at the University of California, San Francisco, who has studied the impact of small gatherings on virus transmission, said this approach is gaining popularity, especially using inexpensive antigen tests. Chin Hong pointed out these tests are less sensitive than costlier PCR tests, which are regarded as the gold standard and better at detecting who's infected than discerning who's not with total certainty. He advised limiting the size of holiday get-togethers and offered a list of things participants shouldn't do, such as huddling closely together at the end of the night as one large group to sing Christmas carols, or debuting your French horn for the guests because wind instruments can create aerosols. For those determined to travel to see friends and or relatives, Chin Hong suggests getting the test done 3 or 4 days before the trip and sticking strictly to a safety protocol. He added this warning: a negative test is only one strategy, and safe practices for COVID prevention should still be maintained as a multimodal strategy to keep us all safe during these trying times. And finally, this article from the Washington Post. With video calls and an army of volunteers, this 15-year-old is battling pandemic loneliness in nursing homes. By Allison Chu, published October 13th. When the coronavirus pandemic left elderly residents in long-term care facilities largely cut off from their families and the outside world in early March, Hita Gupta got to work. Channeling the resources and volunteers of a nonprofit she founded in 2018, Gupta, 15 of Pennsylvania, started sending letters, cards, and care packages to senior homes nationwide, even reaching some facilities in the United Kingdom and Canada. Her efforts garnered her widespread media attention and positive feedback poured in from recipients, but Gupta didn't think the efforts went far enough. While letters and cards are a kind gesture that research has suggested can have a positive impact on mental health, they are one-sided communication, the high school junior said. That cannot be matched by a real-time conversation with the senior, a real conversation where both sides are learning and they're building a bond, said Gupta, who until March had been volunteering on the weekends at a senior living facility near her home in Paoli, a Philadelphia suburb. Being able to speak with someone who's having a hard time, who's experiencing isolation and loneliness, being able to ease some of that tension, I think that's so important. Drawing inspiration from the regular Skype sessions she has with her grandparents, who live in India, Gupta started offering another service to elder care centers: video calls with volunteers from her nonprofit, Brighten a Day. The organization has also been collecting and donating camera-enabled devices such as smartphones, tablets, and laptops to facilities in need, allowing residents more opportunities to virtually connect with their loved ones in addition to volunteers. During the pandemic, the virtual interactions have emerged as a complement to more traditional efforts to reach out to seniors, which have mostly focused on written communication. It's ingenious, said Robert Rocha, chair of the American Psychiatric Association's Council on Geriatric Psychiatry. Somebody expressing interest. Somebody prepared to listen. The experience of having somebody reach out to you, even if it's not a person you know well. There's something very powerful about that in restoring the morale of somebody who's demoralized by loneliness. And that demoralization is being felt by many residents of long-term care facilities. Rocha said a number of his patients in such communities are very unhappy about the level of isolation imposed on them. Research has shown that social isolation and loneliness can trigger a cascade of reactions in the brain and the body, said Brian Carpenter, a professor of psychological and brain sciences at Washington University in St. Louis. They are experiences that trigger a stress response, and that stress response leads to a series of neurological and biochemical changes that are not good for the body over the long term, said Carpenter, who specializes in working with older adults. Several studies in recent years have found correlations between loneliness and adverse health outcomes, suggesting that it may be comparable to other risks, including obesity and smoking. Though there isn't a one-size-fits-all solution to combating loneliness, Rocha emphasized the benefits of feeling connected. And for many older adults who have been isolated amid the pandemic, video calls have emerged as a lifeline, he said. For a lot of people, electronic connections are maybe not everything they would ask for, but they certainly are better than the alternative of not having contact, he said. In recent months, Gupta said her nonprofit has provided about 70 devices to elder care centers in several states and at least one facility in Canada. In addition to purchasing devices, Brighten a Day has received donations from the community, including 100 e-readers and video-enabled tablets from Amazon. Amazon Chief Executive Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post. About 100 volunteers have signed up to participate in calls, Gupta said. Interested facilities receive a spreadsheet listing information about the volunteers, such as their hobbies and what languages they speak, to help match them with residents. Volunteers also go through an orientation that provides guidelines for how to act during a call and tips for facilitating an engaging conversation. Geriatrician and epidemiologist Zhenqi Dong emphasized the importance of ensuring the quality of the interactions. We're all on Skype and Zoom and WebEx calls for hours, and we just tune out, said Dong, director of the Institute for Health, Healthcare Policy, and Aging Research at Rutgers University. Is that really quality connectedness? I would say no. Yet Dong said it is possible to have a 15 to 20 minute intense discussion with someone where you feel very psychologically and socially satisfied. Brandy Barksdale, director of life enrichment at a memory care facility in Pennsylvania, said four of her residents have been speaking weekly with volunteers from Brighten a Day for several months. The facility received a donated tablet in May, Barksdale said. Every time our residents talk to one of the volunteers, they're like overjoyed afterward, and that's all they can talk about, said Barksdale, who works at Artist Senior Living of Huntington Valley. Brighten a Day volunteer Dan Klein, 36, of Chesterbrook, Pennsylvania, said he chatted with the residents from Huntington Valley this month. The group had a lively talk that included discussions about wine and marriage, Klein said. It makes me very happy, said Helen, 83, one of the residents participating in the calls, whose last name is not being published to protect her privacy. It makes me glad to be here. Klein added that he wished the call, which lasted about 30 minutes, could have gone on longer. They were just so happy, just to talk to someone who was new to them, he said. Meanwhile, Jackie Kaminsky, 21, has been video chatting with the same resident at Berkeley Springs Center in West Virginia since the beginning of July. The pair talk over Zoom every week, Kaminsky said, adding that she was recently able to celebrate her resident's birthday with him. It did take time to have him open up, said Kaminsky, a senior at Indiana University. But now they talk about his family and childhood, and he gives her advice on things happening in her life. We have a great rapport, she added. We have this relationship. These conversations can help elderly people in long-term care facilities feel like they are valuable, said Eleanor Feldman Barbara, an expert on aging and mental health based in New York. One of the stages of life, Barbara said, is to feel like you're giving to the next generation. Being able to talk to other people, younger people, and talk about your life and feel like you're passing on your wisdom can be a great way of feeling like you're still accomplishing things and that your years are a benefit to somebody else, she said. It's esteemable. And that is your coronavirus update for this Thursday, November 5th, 2020. from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. Coming up at 2 o'clock, we'll have USA Today for your national news. And then at 3 o'clock, we'll bring the local news to you. Here are some of the articles our volunteers will be reading today. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Wilson and Myers, respect each other, respect COVID-19. Vargas and Joyner talk strategy heading into runoff. Shell unveils new home in West Midland. Oil associations welcome Wright's election to Railroad Commission. From the Odessa American, three city races head to runoffs. Thompson wins District 2 over Minor. Director wants world-class program. And Pfluger wins big in District 11. Those are some of the articles that are coming up at 3 o'clock. And then at 6 o'clock, the Wall Street Journal, followed at 7 with our Texas Monthly Archives program. Tonight, it should be a really good show. In the past few weeks, we lost two Texas singer-songwriters, Jerry Jeff Walker and Billy Joe Shaver. We will have articles on both of those men during this week's Texas Monthly Archives, which premieres tonight at 7 o'clock. As always, thank you for being with us today. Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
The Midland Health Department is providing clinical services by appointment only. Appointments will be scheduled from 8:15 a.m. to 3:45 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Health Department will have immunization clinics 8:15 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday. Appointments are required for immunizations. To schedule an appointment, call 681-7613.
This week on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night Movie, Sandra Bullock stars in The Blind Side.
Who is that, Esther?
Big Mike. He goes to high school here.
What is he wearing? It's below freezing.
Do you have any place to stay tonight? Don't you dare lie to me.
Was this a bad idea?
What's the big deal? It's just for one night. It is just for one night, right, Leanne?
Tell me just one thing I should know about you.
Well, I'd like to be called Big Mike.
Leanne, is this another one of your charities?
I need to find out more about his past.
He's been enrolled in 7 different institutions. His grade point average begins with 0.
He needs to do better in school.
I'd love to work with him.
This is mine?
Yes, sir.
Never had one before.
What, a room to yourself?
A bed.
Michael's grades have improved enough that he can go out for spring football.
How's he doing?
Haven't quite gotten the hang of it yet.
It's all real nice what you're doing, but don't be surprised if one day you wake up and he gone.
I heard you got you a new mama now. She's fine, too.
Michael was here.
Tell him to sleep with one eye open.
You threaten my son. You threaten me.
Sandra Bullock.
Bring a little practice, Leanne.
You can thank me later. His team is your family, Michael. You have to protect him. Tony here is your quarterback. You protect his blind side. When you look at him, you think of me.
Yes, ma'am.
SJ, you're going to want to get this.
Mike's the best left tackle I've seen in years. Better off somehow.
Someday. You're changing that boy's life.
No, he's changing mine.
The Blind Side.
I said you could thank me later. It's later, Bert.
Quentin Aaron, Sandra Bullock, and Tim McGraw star in the audio-described The Blind Side, Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 83 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-70s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
Hello, this is Melanie, and I'm reading articles from today's USA Today, Thursday, November 5th, 2020. Starting with the money section, there are a couple of items. First one, stocks and futures volatile. Stock markets and U.S. futures were volatile again on Wednesday as the world awaited results of tight rate